Hello and welcome to Talking History. This is Brian LeBeau of Creighton University, your host for today's program. Let's begin by taking a brief look at this week, February 9th through 15th, in history. On February 9th, 1943, the World War II Battle of Guadalcanal in the Southwest Pacific ended with an American victory over Japanese forces. On February 10th, 1962, the Soviet Union exchanged captured American U-2 pilot Francis Gary Powers for Rudolf Abel, a Soviet spy held by the United States. On February 12th, 1809, Abraham Lincoln, the 16th President of the United States, was born in present-day LaRue County, Kentucky. On February 13, 1935, a jury in Flemington, New Jersey, found Bruno Richard Hauptmann guilty of first-degree murder in the kidnapped death of the infant son of Charles and Ann Lindbergh. Hauptmann was later executed. And on February 14, 1912, Arizona became the 48th state of the Union. Turning to history in the news, French archaeologists have announced that they have found the tomb of the wet nurse, Tutankhamun, the boy pharaoh whose golden coffin and burial treasures have fascinated generations. The 1330 BC memorial to the servant who suckled the boy king is an extremely rare instance of ancient Egyptians devoting an entire tomb to a woman, the report notes. Also dating to the ancient period, scientists have found what is apparently the earliest known dental implant, a wrought iron tooth, in a man who lived about 1900 years ago in what is now France. The discovery was made in a cemetery south of Paris, dating to the period when that area was called Gaul and ruled by the Romans. The Vatican has announced that it will allow scholars to examine more files that recount the banning of books and heresy cases, including some files on the infamous Inquisition. Scholars will have the opportunity to look at newly accessible files that date back about four centuries and extend to 1902. It is not known, however, whether new information will be made available on the case of Italian astronomer Galileo, who was condemned in 1633 for contending that the Earth was not the center of the universe, contrary to church teachings at the time. And finally, an international team of researchers has exonerated Albert Einstein on a long-standing allegation that he plagiarized his famous general theory of relativity. Some historians of science have suggested that he may have stolen his ideas on relativity from David Hilbert, a German mathematician who developed a parallel equivalent version of the theory independently a few days before Einstein published his famous paper in 1915. Researchers have now found documents that they insist proves that Einstein alone devised the complete final version of the theory. So, no need to throw away all those Einstein t-shirts. For the major segment of our show today, I'm pleased to welcome back once again to our microphone Creighton historian Robert Hopkins. Robert will be interviewing James H. Jones, University of Houston historian, on his recently published biography of Alfred C. Kinsey. Robert?
Thank you, Brian. During the late 1940s, Americans saw what they perceived as dangerous external and internal assaults on American culture and traditions. The Soviet Union acquired the atomic bomb. China fell to communism, and there was labor unrest and war scares at home. Perhaps the most significant challenge to American mores and traditions came not from Soviet bombs or socialist fifth columnists, but from a zoology professor at Indiana University, Alfred Kinsey. In 1948, he published Sexual Behavior in the Human Male, the first of several studies which effectively shattered the long-standing Victorian silence about American sexual culture. In a masterful new biography entitled Alfred C. Kinsey, A Public-Private Life, published by W.W. Norton, University of Houston history professor James H. Jones not only tells us about Kinsey the man, but about how American science in general affected the ideas and morality of the American people. Welcome, Professor Jones.
Thank you. I'm happy to be on your show.
Good, good. Very briefly, can you tell us about Kenzie the man? You've done a little bit more than most people in the past. Who was he, and why was he so peculiarly suited to this mission?
Well, Kenzie was a lot more interesting than we thought. I think the original Kenzie canon was that he was a disinterested scientist who saw a hole in the scientific literature, and because he abhorred a vacuum in knowledge, he decided to fill it. The person that I came to know after many years of research was, I think, to his fingertips, a social reformer. I believe that Kinsey's interest in human sexual behavior was a result of his own conflicted sexual identity, and that he tried to work out in a public forum through science his own quest for understanding.
So how was Kinsey himself affected by the moral culture of the early 1900s, the time in which he was growing?
When Kinsey was born in the late 19th century and was an adolescent, really, at the turn of the century, he lived at a time in which Americans were going through a crisis of civilized morality. They worried that the rise of industrialization and big cities had sapped the vitality out of American youth, and that American males might not be able to measure up to their fathers and grandfathers. So he grew up at a time in which, really, male identity was very contested terrain. As part of that concern at the turn of the century, I think there was a great deal of emphasis on sexual purity. Kinsey himself grew up in a family that was deeply religious and, by any standards, very repressive. He was not allowed to smoke. He was not allowed to drink. He was not allowed to date. He was not allowed to play cards. He grew up in a family that was extremely, extremely strict. I think as a youth, when Kinsey began to explore his own sexuality, I think he was guilt-stricken. I don't think he was able to grant himself the absolutions that many young people are as they explore their own identities. And I think this left Kinsey very guilty and really unsure about his identity.
So in many ways, not only was it the normal youthful angst associated with sexual awareness and identity, but Kinsey found himself burdened by YMCA manuals, Boy Scout manuals, as well as his own family pressure that emphasized this purity of youth, if you will.
That's correct. And in Kinsey's case, you have a person who is really a great overachiever. Every task he puts himself to, he tries to strive for perfection. And in so many areas, you mentioned the Boy Scouts. Kinsey was one of the first Eagle Scouts of the United States. In the YMCA, he was a mainstay of that organization. He devotes himself to those groups and organizations at the turn of the century that are concerned with character and with social service. And everywhere, he tries to be the best that he can be. It's just this one area of his life that when he holds himself to the very high standards that he set for himself that he's not able to achieve, it's this area that really gives him problems.
One of the things that you let us know about is that for many people, especially at the time, they considered Kinsey to be a second Darwin. What's that all about?
Well, Kinsey's classmates were much impressed by his intellect, as well they should have been. He was the valedictorian of a high school class that was extremely competitive. Kinsey, as a youth, fell in love with nature. He took nature walks, and he started giving nature lectures to his classmates, and he was much in demand as a circuit lecturer around South Orange. And over time, his classmates came to regard him in a very high manner and to think that he might have a chance of becoming really a very important scientist. In his high school class book, it was his classmates who called him a second Darwin. Now, that sort of hyperbole is commonplace to high school books of that sort. But in Kinsey's case, it didn't seem far-fetched or unreal. I think he really asked of himself that he achieved great things in science.
Well, curiously, for many of our listeners, I'm sure they're unaware that Kinsey began his scholarly career not in any kind of human sexuality, psychology, or anything, any research related to that, but in fact was a taxonomist who studied gall wasps. How did that specific influence affect his research?
Well, when Kinsey went into the field of taxonomy, most taxonomists were willing to settle for a handful of specimens when they would then start to generalize about the species under study. One of Kinsey's contributions to the field of taxonomy was to insist that many, many specimens were required before one could generalize. He insisted that because he was fascinated by the theme of individual variation in nature. What struck him about nature as being awe-inspiring was its diversity. And he felt that only by cataloging in huge samples the diversity of nature could you begin to understand the mechanics of evolution. So when he later becomes a sex researcher, one of the hallmarks of that work will be his insistence upon large samples.
Right. In fact, you mentioned that he was called, what was it, the 100,000 man, looking for that huge number of samples in an effort to get a more objective assessment of the
sexual. That's correct. In fact, in college, his classmates called him, not in college, but in graduate school at Harvard, his classmates called him Get a Million Kinsey.
Get a Million Kinsey, sure, because that million interviews, and he really made a commitment to do that, didn't he?
Well, after he became a sex researcher, he did set his sights really on the 100,000 goal. That's where that figure comes from. The 1 million pertained to the gall wasp earlier in his career. But he really thought that it was not far-fetched or not impossible that he could compile 100,000 sex histories.
Kinsey was an absolute, forgive me if I use this improperly, fanatic when it comes to his work. He was devoted, he was excessive, zealous. In fact, some of his students were actually critical of him as being excessive, whether it was studying gall wasps or whatever. Was Kinsey a tough man to work for?
I think he was. I think Kinsey was a perfectionist. I think he was hard on himself. I think he drove people around him past the breaking point. Again, he has this fierce voice from within that constantly scolds him and tells him to work harder. But the other side of that, and to really give credit to the man, is that there's also this love and joy in discovery. Science is really the grammar of his existence, and he's never happier than when he's on the trail of some scientific pursuit.
One of the times when he might be happy but not in pursuit of science, of course, were the musicales, the weekly get-togethers where Kinsey played music for a very captive audience and gave a brief lecture on that. Did that really represent not only his interest in music, but more or less his obsessive need to be in control?
I think so. I think in Kinsey's case, you have a person who is always preoccupied, really, with issues of power and control. I go into that, those features of his personality at some length in the book. In those musicales, Kinsey was very much the impresario of the evening. I mean, he made things happen, and the people who heard music in his home had to listen in raptured silence. And if they didn't keep silent, he would police them into polite passivity.
You bet. They weren't invited back next time.
Again, he's this very strong character.
One of the things that you mark so adequately, I think, and is worth remembering, is that for Kinsey, his commitment to challenging American sexual mores really became a crusade. As you write in your book, quote, "The essence of Kinsey's gospel was simple. Sexual morality needed to be reformed, and science would show the way." Is this the quintessential Kinsey?
I think it is. I think Kinsey was a man with a mission. I think the job that he set himself to was to use science as a tool to liberate Americans from what he saw as antiquated and really mean-spirited Victorian repression of human sexual affairs. And he dedicates himself to that cause and makes it really the great cause of his life.
Did Kinsey start the sexual revolution?
No, of course not. Kinsey is, is just one of those protein scientists and kind of late Victorians who moves it along. There's an old saying, I think Crane Britton's the originator, but no ideas, no revolution.
So in many ways, Kinsey was, shall we say, a number cruncher. He was great at collecting data, great at extrapolating that, his use of statistics, for example. Would you say that Kinsey was not a brilliant, great intellect in the sense of great thinkers like an Einstein or a Newton?
Well, most scientists who make huge contributions to their fields do so through elegant theory. In Kinsey's case, what you have is a person whose primary contribution is methodology. But methodology, as any good science will tell you, is the soul of science, and it will get you a long way if you harness it to the kind of muscular will that he had.
And Kinsey used that will to make a transition from studying gall wasps, first to teaching a course on marriage at the University of Indiana, and ultimately towards creating the Kinsey Institute and others.
Correct. The obstacles that would have confronted anyone doing the work that he wanted to do were certainly large. What Kinsey did was to simply be stronger than the obstacles he confronted. He displayed courage in the face of opposition, He displayed the kind of passion and dedication to his research that made people respect him, and I think he was able to persuade people around him that science could do a good job studying human sexuality.
So in many ways, this allegory of the second Darwin may apply as well to his modern period because of the hostility that Darwin and his champions like Huxley faced. So too did Kinsey face that kind of Victorian reaction about the subject of human sexuality.
Well, Kinsey certainly saw himself in that tradition. He was not above comparing himself with Galileo or Copernicus or Darwin. He felt that the opposition that he confronted was real. He knew it was real from experience. And he felt that it took the same kind of dedication to changing paradigms and really changing people's thoughts that his predecessors in the history of science had experienced.
One of the things Kinsey had to face, which is perhaps peculiar to more 20th century science, was a need for funding. How did this issue affect Kinsey's research, his public persona, and his private life?
Well, without money, you can't do the kind of large-scale interviewing that Kinsey did. He simply had to have a patron. And he was very fortunate in that the Rockefeller Foundation, really a few decades before he got started, had become interested in human sexual questions and had funded a committee from the National Research Council, a committee called the Committee for Research and Problems of Sex, and given it money to attract first-rate scientists into studying a number of questions of human sexuality. What Kinsey was able to do was to persuade Robert Yerkes and George Corner and other important scientists who served on that committee that he was the man in whom the Rockefeller Foundation should invest its money.
And he was fairly successful at that, although many of our readers and listeners may not be aware that he ended up, in confrontation with none other than Dean Rusk, who would go on to become Secretary of State?
That's correct. Kinsey is doing his research in the late 40s and early 50s at the exact moment in American history in which a number of people are preoccupied with the Cold War, in which McCarthyism is really casting its ugly shadow over the national landscape. And Kinsey really gets at odds with Dean Rusk, who's the president of the Rockefeller Foundation, because conservatives, right-wing, really, conservatives, accuse Kinsey of being a communist and accuse the Rockefeller Foundation of being duped by communists because they support him.
How did the American people react not only to Kinsey's work, of course, to the 1948 publication? Were they sympathetic? Were they interested? Did they see this as Cold War science, or did they react on a personal level?
Well, the reactions were all over the place. Everything you just mentioned, had people who felt that way. There were some who thought it was, Cold War, communist-inspired work. There were others who felt that it was cutting-edge science. There were others who felt that it was godless science and bent upon destroying the moral fabric of the country. The thing that made Kinsey's work so unique, I think, was that it precipitated probably the most sustained debate and dialogue on sexual questions in this nation's history. It was a great debate, and it lasted for years.
Well, Kinsey wasn't afraid to dive into related debates such as birth control or limiting the spread of venereal disease. How did these collateral debates and Kinsey's association with them affect his overall research as well as popular support for him?
Well, I think the other reform movements that you refer to, like social hygiene and like birth control, prepared the American public to deal with sexual issues that had long been buried. To that extent, they opened the field for Kinsey. But what Kinsey does, of course, is to interact with birth controllers and to give them really information that helps them in their work, so it's very much a symbiotic relationship.
One of the things that struck me throughout your book was the person that we seldom hear about, and that's Clara, his wife. What can you briefly tell us about her and how she played a part in Kinsey's work?
Well, I think Clara was a brilliant woman. She certainly, as an undergraduate, won academic prizes and impressed her professors as being an outstanding student. When she marries Kinsey, they develop a very close marriage. They have four children, three of whom live, one of whom dies in infancy. And she really wants to be his helpmate to further his career and to put her back into issues that he cares about. Over time, Kinsey himself becomes a sexual rebel, and I think Clara joins him on that odyssey. and she wants to stay close to his work, in sexual behavior, and so she makes herself his assistant in some of those areas as well.
Dr. Jones, in our last minute remaining, if you will, please, many critics have argued that Kinsey's pursuit of the question of human sexuality was really either a case of the dispassionate scientist in pursuit of some quixotic knowledge, or perhaps someone who was trying to satisfy his own confused sadomasochistic homosexual tendencies, or something equally extreme like that. Is there a more important or a better message here for us about Alfred Kinsey?
Yeah, I think Alfred Kinsey, putting aside, issues of private behavior, is a reformer who wants to have a place in society for groups that historically had been despised. I think he is a friend to gays. I think he's a person who wants to lower the pressure on young people about masturbation and about exploring their sexuality. I think he wants to end the hush and pretend conspiracy of Victorian morality, and I think he wants to have an ethic of tolerance and acceptance that makes people much less at war with themselves.
Well, I'm very grateful for that, I think, really succinct summary, and I would like to remind our listeners that we've been chatting today with Professor James Jones from the University of Houston, and I'd urge you to take a look at his new biography on Alfred Kinsey. Thank you very much, Dr. Jones.
Thank you, Robert, for having me.
To conclude this week's show, it's time to let an historian have his say about an issue in the news. Offering this week's historical perspective is Paul Finkelman, the Baker and Hostetler Visiting Professor at the Cleveland Marshall College of Law at Cleveland State University. The title of Professor Finkelman's radio op-ed piece is Term Limits, Thank Goodness We Didn't Have Them in 1787.
Once again, Congress has debated and, at least for the moment, defeated a proposed constitutional amendment on term limits. One of the main arguments in favor of term limitations has been the idea that the framers of the Constitution did not expect government to be run by professional politicians. A subtext of the term limit advocates is that there is something corrupt or evil about being a professional politician. Such notions would have seemed odd to the nation's founders. Thomas Jefferson, for example, was first elected to public office in 1769 when the 26-year-old lawyer won a seat in Virginia's colonial legislature. With the exception of a brief period in 1782-83, Jefferson remained in public office for the next 40 years. He served in the National Congress, the Virginia Legislature, as Governor of Virginia, as an ambassador, as U.S. Secretary of State, Vice President, and finally President. He was, by any measure, a professional politician. Madison, Jefferson's close friend and neighbor, was also a professional politician. Madison's career began in 1775. He was in the Virginia Legislature, the Continental Congress, the Constitutional Convention, the new Congress, Secretary of State, and finally he became president. He left office in 1817 at age 67 after two terms as president. Another famous founder, Roger Sherman, was a signer of the Declaration of Independence and a drafter of the Constitution. He held office almost continuously from 1769 until his death in 1793. He served seven consecutive terms in Congress, as well as in the U.S. House. He died in the Senate. Under a term limits rule, he might have been booted out of Congress. In the early 19th century, Henry Clay entered politics in 1803. He served in the Senate until 1811, when he went to the House, where he remained until 1821. Fortunately, there was no term limitations to kick Henry Clay out before he could guide the Missouri Compromise through Congress. He then went back to the Senate in 1831 and served until 1852. There he guided the Compromise of 1850 through Congress. Without Clay, the country might have fallen apart long before the Civil War. term limits might have kept him out of Congress or the Senate at crucial times. The framers of the Constitution knew about term limits. Many states had them at the time, but they wisely decided that representative government requires that the people be able to choose their representatives from their most qualified fellow citizens. If we need a lawyer, we ask for one who has experience with our problem. On the operating table, we prefer the older, experienced surgeon to the young intern. Corporate presidents are rarely chosen from the ranks of lower management. The framers knew it was the same in government. Experience matters. Given the choice, the wisdom of James Madison and his fellow framers ought to prevail over that of Newt Gingrich and his term limit followers.
You've been listening to Paul Finkelman, Baker and Hostetler Visiting Professor at Cleveland Marshall College of Law at Cleveland State University. His commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. If you have any comments to offer, questions to raise, or topics to suggest for future programs, send them to us either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu, or by regular mail at Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau. Thank you.